obviously it's getting everyone's interest. And we're very fortunate today in having Sir David Omond, who I'm sure many of you know already, who was, of course, the first UK Security and Intelligence Coordinator, but more pointedly for today, chaired the recent Birmingham Policy Commission report, The Security Impact of Drones, which was published on the 22nd of October, which I'm sure a number of you will have read. And he, in that, I think they anticipate a lead role for the UK in building international consensus concerning regulation of some of these weapon systems. But it's a fascinating study and well worth reading. And Elizabeth Wilmshurst, again, who I'm sure many of you know, an associate fellow of Chatham House and a distinguished diplomat, and Maya Brennan, a Geneva academic researcher who will be speaking third. And what I hope to do is to let each of you speak in turn to touch on this subject, because this was called originally as APPG as a feed-in to the Convention on Conventional Weapons meeting in Geneva on the 13th and 14th of November, so we could have some sort of discussion and talk about the various issues involved. I'm not quite sure exactly what output we hope to get from this, but I think it'll develop as we hear people speaking and other people talk. And then we possibly will put together some letter or something like that as a result of the discussions. But that's really the maximum that will come out from it. So Dave, could I ask you to kick off, please?
Well, thank you very much. And can I start by expressing my thanks to the APG for the opportunity earlier in the year to discuss our emerging findings of the Policy Commission and for your feedback on them. I hope you're going to find our final report a useful reference, and there are spare copies available. Elizabeth Wilmshurst was a member of the Commission, and we also have Professor Nicholas Wheeler and Paul Shorty from the Commission here in the room with us. The baseline, I suppose you might say, for the consideration of the subject today was our finding that the Royal Air Force's remotely piloted aircraft, which we prefer as a term to drones, have proved invaluable in operations in Afghanistan, mainly for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. And in that role, of course, they are now operating over Iraq and most recently over Syrian territory. They have also proved their worth in the armed mode for the protection of British forces when we were deployed in Afghanistan. And we describe that past use of British RPA in the report. The starting point, I think, for looking at autonomous systems is the section in our report in which we set out a vision for 2035 of what might be achievable. It might, in some cases, be difficult, but might be achievable by the British government working in cooperation with its partners overseas. By 2035, for example, we should be in a position where the use of remotely piloted aircraft, in other words, with a pilot, albeit on the ground rather than in the air, in command of the aircraft, where RPA is seen as an integral, essential, and normal component of UK air power, operating at all times strictly within UK law and the UK interpretation of international law. And crucial to achieving that aim, we concluded, was treating RPA and its deployments overseas in the same light as other types of military equipment, keeping Parliament informed under the existing arrangements for overseas deployment. And the key is the confidence that we will be using RPA in accordance with our understanding of international law, including the vital principles of distinction and proportionality. And provided that we're confident that is the case, we didn't, as a commission, regard the various ethical objections which have been raised against the concept of the remotely piloted aircraft to be of substance. And we analyse, we devote a substantial part of the report to our analysis of why it is that this technology does not have to lead to a slippery slope at the bottom of which would be lethal autonomous weapon systems or killer robots in the popular phrase. But in that period up to, say, 2035, we do predict that the technologies that are relevant will have continued to advance, including stealth, weight reduction, advanced communications, automation of processes such as navigation and manoeuvring. We must expect robotics to have rapidly developed and spread, including within the civilian economy. Against a high technology adversary, especially in the air, where speed of response, immunity, detection and jamming will matter, a higher degree of automation in RPA will offer unparalleled capacities for achieving aerial dominance. But, crucially, we drew a distinction between what I've just described, RPA with ever more sophisticated degrees of automation, and autonomous weapon systems. And our approach has been to identify potential technological advances in automation, such as takeoff and landing and navigation and target acquisition, which are not ethically or legally problematic, provided always there is a pilot on the ground who has genuine responsibility for the weapons release decision. There is therefore a spectrum of automation. But we don't think you can be a little bit autonomous. Once you have a weapons system without a pilot on the ground involved in and capable of taking responsibility for weapon release, then the system is no longer remotely piloted. It's capable of demonstrating volition and intention. And as a commission, we simply did not see it being possible in the conceivable state of technology to program a capacity for distinction and proportionality as defined under international humanitarian law into such a system. We thought they were really extraordinarily challenging, and we would say almost certainly impossible, engineering and programming tasks to design an autonomous system that could operate in a complex and messy operational environment. And before deployment, and I defer to Elizabeth on the legal test that would be needed, but before you could deploy such a system, you would have to be sure that it could in practice apply the principles of distinction between, for example, what's a legitimate military target that could be attacked in accordance with international humanitarian law, and the people who require protection, civilians, surrendering forces, prisoners of war. Automated systems are predictable. An autonomous system would almost certainly have to incorporate the ability to learn in order to cope with the near infinite array of possible situations it might face. Its behaviour, therefore, could not be predictable. Could not be predicted in all relevant circumstances. So, in short, we don't think we can program the necessary capacity for judgment required into such a machine. Now, we should be aiming, we say in the report, to try and understand better the moral implications of machine autonomy. That will occur in the civil sector. But, as I've said, we do have severe doubts as to whether you could have a successor to an RPA, which was an autonomous lethal weapons system. So we supported the decision of both the British and American governments not to develop laws, lethal autonomous weapon systems, but we do caution that other nations may not be as scrupulous. And we hope that the US, the UK, other NATO allies, other like-minded, ethically concerned states will insist as a norm that there should be active human control consistent with the requirements of distinction in the use of force under international humanitarian law in their weapons system. We encourage the British government to take a leading role in the discussions under the Convention in Geneva, the CCW discussions, to try and secure a new and widely endorsed international normative framework. We did discuss the possibility of a ban on development. We didn't reach a final view on the question. There are formidable technical problems about how you would negotiate it, how you would define the technologies, how you would verify it. So, as a first step, what we said was engage fiercely in Geneva, try and take the lead, and try and develop, as I say, a norm which would really be international agreement. The distinctions that are necessary under IHL are ones that must be adhered to in the future development of weapon systems. And even such a statement, widely agreed internationally, would raise the stakes for any government that was tempted to develop weapon systems that would break international law.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much indeed. Elizabeth, can I ask you to?
Thank you. I've been asked to talk about the law, but I have to ask your indulgence, really, because people are so familiar with the legal principles applicable in this area. But I'll skip lightly through them, if I may. We're talking about international humanitarian law here, or the law of armed conflict. The terms are synonymous. So with regard to the use of any weapon in armed conflict, the first rule is that the weapon or weapon system must not per se be illegal. And for that purpose, Article 36 of the Additional Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions requires states to review new weapons to assess whether their use would be contrary to international law. And thus, for example, a weapon would not be lawful if it was acquired or developed if it couldn't possibly maintain the distinction between civilians and combatants, or if its harmful effects couldn't be limited, like biological weapons. International humanitarian rules could be relevant in a weapons review, depending on whether the weapon was to be used in circumstances in which human rights apply. Secondly, in armed conflict, the use of any weapon has to conform with the rules of international law, and in summary, that's basically the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precautions in attack. The principle of distinction, very familiar. You have to be able to distinguish between civilians and combatants. Civilians may not be targeted. States may lawfully attack only persons and objects which make an effective contribution to military action. Civilians enjoy the protection accorded by IHL so long as they don't take a direct part in hostilities. Indiscriminate attacks are prohibited, and so it's just worth pausing on that. Indiscriminate attacks, that means attacks which are not directed at a specific military objective, or attacks which employ a means of combat which cannot be directed at a specific military objective, or the effects of which can't be limited. So that's the principle of distinction. Secondly, the principle of proportionality. Even if a target is defined as a legitimate military one, attacks are prohibited if they may be expected to cause incidental loss of civilian life or to civilians, civilian objects, etc., which would be excessive in relation to the concrete and direct military advantage anticipated. Of course, a terribly difficult assessment to make, but nevertheless, there it is, the principle of proportionality, and it is an important one. And thirdly, precautions in attack. Everything feasible must be done to avoid attacks that breach the principle of distinction or of proportionality. And an attack has to be cancelled or suspended if it becomes apparent that it is going to breach the IHL rules. So there we have the three major principles of international humanitarian law. They're set out in treaty law, but they're well recognised as being international customary law, so binding on all states, whether or not they're parties, and of course the US is not a party to the additional protocol. those principles were written in treaty law as applying in international armed conflict, but in these big transnational, non-international armed conflicts, they're also applicable. Depending on the circumstances in which the weapons are used, international human rights law could also be applicable. We could talk about that later, but really human rights is more applicable in law enforcement operations, and perhaps we're not going to be using autonomous weapons in those circumstances. Breach of the rules of international humanitarian law results in accountability, international responsibility for the states concerned, and possibly the commission of war crimes by the individuals concerned or the commanders. So the application of these principles, with regard to remotely piloted aircraft, these principles are perfectly possible to apply. Indeed, some people say they're easier to apply because you have somebody watching possible persons to be attacked to actually be able to distinguish more easily as to whether they are civilians or not. With regard to autonomous weapons, however, there is more of a problem. First, you have the requirement for review of the weapons. According to an ICRC briefing I was reading, it's not clear how future autonomous weapons could be adequately tested for the purpose of review, given the absence of standard methods for testing and evaluating autonomous systems. So even the requirement for review might be a little difficult to apply as of now. The principles of distinction, proportionality, and precautions in attack. The UK and many others say it's not possible to program a machine to undertake the qualitative judgments that are required for the application of those principles. I have seen writers who say that it would be possible to apply IHL to fully automated weapons, autonomous weapons, at least in some environments, so if you had air-to-air combat in a desert or an undersea anti-submarine operation. There's room for argument there. But even those writers admit that the principle of precautions in attack, doing everything feasible to avoid unlawful attacks, would be very difficult to meet. So are the rules adequate for the future, or do we need more? Leaving aside the question of a ban, if we don't go for a ban, there is the argument, and certainly we made that in the Birmingham Commission report, that a new instrument could make clear that fully autonomous systems would be governed by the rules of international humanitarian law. I was trying to speculate what else could such an instrument say, whether it was a treaty, perhaps not a good idea, or an understanding, an agreed understanding by states, or some kind of soft law. As well as setting out that they're subject to IHL, it could perhaps set out agreed common standards and best practice for the Article 36 review as regards future weapons systems. And the review should be undertaken during the development of a system and not just wait until a fully fledged system. The review would need to be constantly renewed. Thirdly, you could include an interpretative application of IHL for those deploying autonomous systems, explaining what information they must have and what criteria they must be applying before deciding to field the weapons in a given situation, because obviously in very many situations there would be no way in which autonomous weapons could comply with IHL. Next, I was looking at the US Department of Defense Directive of 2012, which talks of the need for appropriate levels of human judgment. And I know the next speaker will be talking about the necessity for a meaningful human role. So perhaps in any future agreement of any kind, we need to consider whether autonomous weapon systems should have a human override capability or some such. And states should be required to make public their own national rules and policies on the development of highly automated weapons systems, which should conform with the international understanding. And finally, the question of accountability. Again, the ICRC is concerned about how responsibility could be attributed in relation to acts of autonomous machines that are totally unpredictable. How can a human be held responsible for a machine of which they have no control? So you have questions of accountability which would need to be discussed. I want to say I'm only talking about the law, and of course the law is not the only issue here. Morals and ethics come in, but I'll leave that to others. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Thank you. Mayor.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'm honored to be able to address you today here. Very impressive to me, this entire building, the entire setup, from Switzerland, where everything is much, much smaller. Thank you to my co-speakers here. That was very interesting, these presentations, and I think a very, very good introduction to what I am going to talk about, which is the question of meaningful human control and how we would like to see this ensured in any weapon systems developed in the future. I work for the Geneva Academy of International Humanitarian Law and Human Rights, and I also work with Article 36, who are co-organizing this event and are based in London. And Article 36, together with other civil society organizations, are calling for a preemptive, comprehensive ban under international law on the development, the production, and the use of what we call fully autonomous weapon systems. Weapon systems that operate without meaningful human control over individual attacks. Focusing on human control, I think, allows us to articulate concerns around weapon systems in terms of our own role as human beings in the use of weapons. And it invites us to ask questions about what we want that role to be today and in the future. And as we are confronted with plans by some states to develop increasingly autonomous weapon systems, we can ask, for example, what we have come to expect in terms of human control over weapons and over the effects of weapons, and why it is that some technologies or practices of armed violence are deemed acceptable from the perspective of human control, whilst others are contested or have been rejected and formally prohibited. And I think how we orient toward these questions in relation to existing weapons provides critical guidance for positioning ourselves in relation to emerging weapon technologies. So let me start with an extreme hypothetical scenario. A weapon system that roams at will and detects and selects and fires at objects or persons without any form of human oversight, without reporting back to a human operator. Now, this would likely not be something that any state would argue in favor of, and I think it's fairly uncontroversial that a weapon system that operates outside of any kind of human control would not be acceptable. And in fact, several states, including the UK government, have made statements to the effect that weapons must always be under human control. So clearly the exercise of human control over weapons is a key feature of how we govern the use of force today, and that control relates to who possesses weapons, who can use them, and to what ends, and the control over when and where and how they are used, and the control over the effects that they produce. And human control, as we have heard right before, is also an element that legal responsibility is tied to, and in some cases remedies for the consequences of weapons use and rights. So the concern is that in the future development of increasingly autonomous weapon systems, future systems may come to erode what we would today consider to be necessary in terms of human control, and that weapon systems may be developed that operate without meaningful human control. So with increasing autonomy in weapon systems over the detection and selection and engagement of targets, the dependence of the weapon system on human intervention in these particular functions, and thus on human control over these functions, may become detached or reduced or entirely removed. The key question then is not whether weapons should remain under human control, they do, but what this human control should look like, what it is understood to be. And so So consider another extreme hypothetical scenario of a person that would press a button to authorize a weapon system to fire every time a light came on, but without having any other information. States are not likely to be in favor of this scenario either. And I think it shows that we actually recognize that human control over weapons must be more than formalistic. So having a person in the loop or on the loop or touching the loop is not in and of itself enough to ensure that human control is being exercised in a meaningful way. And so somewhere there is a boundary where human control over weapon systems ceases to be meaningful or adequate or sufficient. And I think this of central importance here, and you've heard it before, is one aspect of this is information. The information that's available to persons or persons who are responsible for making decisions and judgments about the use of weapons. And existing legal rules governing the use of weapons, the rules of international humanitarian law, but also a range of other rules, in my view, they imply that those who plan or decide upon an attack, that is, those that are responsible for the attack, that they possess information about the target of the specific attack, its military significance at the moment of the attack, that makes the military, the question whether that target, that object is a target and is a military objective in the legal sense, the attack environment, the weapon that is being used, the kinetic effects, the method of use, and information about the desired and undesired effects that could result from the use. And only with this information can an attack predict with a sufficient degree of confidence what effects will result from an attack, and so engage in the deliberations and choices that are necessary for the application of the legal rules. A requirement to possess certain types of information, and I would argue also the means and the time and the processes that enable humans to make sense of information, is therefore implicit in the existing legal framework. And the result of these deliberations are always dependent on the context of every individual attack. And so we can ask, for example, what is the form and the content and the timeliness of information about an individual attack that those responsible for the attack must have? What is needed to predict the effects of an attack? And when are we no longer confident that the law can adequately be applied? So how do we in current practice ensure that those responsible for an attack have the necessary information? One way by which we ensure that is by placing limitations on the time and the space within which a weapon system operates independently, and as well as limitations on how valid targets of attack are described and identified, and limitations on the effects that are brought to bear. To give you an example of an existing weapon system that quite well illustrates this problematic, it's the case of sensor-fused weapons. Once that weapon, such a weapon is released, the sensors search for objects within the sensor's coverage area that match a predefined set of parameters, such as a heat signature of a tank engine, for example. And when the sensors detect a matching object, the weapon strikes that object. So in this example, the final determination of the target to attack is made by the sensors and computer algorithms. After the weapon's launch, therefore, the person launching the weapon, in this case, this is still quite proximate in time, but after the launch, the person has no further control over what the weapon will target, and it will simply, in this case, strike the first object that was identified as matching the criteria. And so but the area within which the sensors search for a target is positioned, and its dimensions are determined by a human operator. So critical aspects of how human control is exercised over weapons pertain to the programming of the target parameters, sensor mechanisms, and the space within which and the time during which a weapon is allowed to operate independently of human control. And questions that we can ask in this connection are, for example, and someone has raised it before, what characterizes environments within which existing weapon systems are permitted to operate independently? And what criteria are used to assess the acceptability of limitations on the independent operation of weapon systems? Now, some existing limitations take the form of legal restrictions or prohibitions. You can think of legal restrictions in the use of anti-vehicle landmines, for example. Other limitations are of a technical nature, or they result from operational or national policy choices. And as we look to the future, we may see moves to allow weapon systems to operate independently over wider areas of space during longer times and in different environments. And the concern is, of course, that at some stage there may no longer be meaningful human control over individual attacks. And so whilst I think it is implicit in legal rules that such control is exercised, there is no international legal rule that explicitly requires that. And such a legal requirement would provide a basis for assessing the acceptability of future weapon developments and a framework for elaborating further guidance on what constitutes meaningful or adequate or sufficient control. And I think the UK government has made some statements and has some policy documents in place that provide a good starting point. But beyond asserting that there will always be human control and that the law is complied with, I think it's critical that the government articulate national policy on this question in more detail and says what that actually would mean to have human control. And as Lord Admiral West has said, next week the states' parties to the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons are meeting in Geneva, and that would be a good opportunity for the government to support a mandate for continued formal discussions of governmental experts on this topic. And such discussions should also consider the question of what it means to exercise meaningful human control over a weapon system, as well as the wider ethical and moral questions that increasingly autonomous weapons raise. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for all three of those presentations, which I think were fascinating and very pertinent to what we're talking about. What I'd like to do is now throw it open. It seems, I mean, I think that you would...